God, we thank you for just another day, another moment. We thank you for what we affirmed together through those songs this morning, that you are risen, that you are alive. And so that when we gather together and we talk about you and we sing to you and we open the scriptures and talk about what it means to live the Jesus way, we're not doing it alone. We're doing it with you as you empower us because you're alive. And we also, we recognize as we sang this morning that you're good. And we just pray that you'll help us to, this morning, to really center in and kind of get rid of any distractions that may clutter our hearts. And help us to be fully present in this moment to talk about what you're saying and doing in this moment. We love you and we're grateful for this journey that you've called us into. And it's our prayer that you would help us to live faithfully as we take the next step and the next step and the next step. We pray this in Jesus' name. And everybody said, amen. So I grew up in church. I was going to church from the time I came into the world, pretty much. And I had experience through several different church denominations. And one of the things I found through most of my experiences to be true is that in the Western world, particularly, I'll say this, particularly in the Bible Belt, where we are the buckle, right? We are in the Bible Belt. Typically, we have a very certain view. When you hear the word salvation, there are certain things that we believe and hold to be true about what salvation is. And so I would say some of this. I think our view of salvation is we very much focused on destination, right? Salvation is all about destination, which is where we get the question, do you know where you're going to spend eternity, right? It's all about destination. Are you ready for eternity? Have you done something to get your heart ready from this moment until whatever is next? It often is focused on arrival. Like salvation is this arrival. It's getting from one place to the other. Often we speak of salvation in past tense. So we'll ask somebody the question, when were you saved? Like a past tense sort of thing. When I was a kid, I grew up, the first 11 years of my life, I spent in a Free Will Baptist church. And we, at different special occasions and revivals and those sorts of things, they would have this song they would sing. And I'll just tell you the words if that's okay. I mean, I know some of you have been waiting for my big debut, but we'll put that off. But it was on a Sunday, somebody touched me. It was on a Sunday, somebody touched me. It was on a Sunday, somebody touched me. Must have been the hand of the Lord. Know the song? And what, during the song, on the day of the week that you were saved, you're supposed to stand up. But see, as a kid, I'd been saved like 15 times. So I didn't know what day. I stood up for every day, and I would just be proud of it. Like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I got saved once on a Sunday, and I'm pretty sure it happened on a Monday. And there's that one time I messed up on that Wednesday and asked for forgiveness, so we'll count that too. And so it was kind of just like up and down, up and down. And so salvation is this thing in the past. It's when did you go down front? When did you cry? When did you make that decision to be saved? And now you're on with it, and it's in the past. Often, we approach salvation like it's a ticket. Right? It's how preachers often present salvation. Like, have you got your ticket? Because the glory train's leaving the station, right? Have you got your ticket? Are you ready? Have you got your hand stamped so that when you are at the gate and St. Peter is checking hand stamps, you've got your hands, you can get in and you can ride all the rides. Like, you have the full pass. Have you had that experience? And I think often for us, we don't really articulate it. We don't mean it necessarily maybe even this way, but we kind of articulate it this way. That salvation is basically being saved is like this moment when God takes this big dump truck and it beep, 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 and just unloads everything on us. So in that moment when you pray that prayer, you have become someone that you never have been before in your life. You are completely and totally changed. You love people you used to hate. You forgive people you used to have grudges against. You don't speed anymore. You don't steal office supplies. Everything's completely changed and different. You are a completely, totally different person. And so that's kind of, there's just this dump truck. God gives you all of it in one moment. And I think the reason that many of us walk around feeling guilty and shameful all the time is because we've been kind of given this dump truck view. So that like in that moment when you prayed that prayer, God gave you everything you ever needed. And so when you find yourself in a situation where you gossip, or you find yourself in a situation where you do the wrong thing, where you know you should forgive somebody but you're harboring a grudge, or you find yourself in that situation where you know you should show compassion but you end up showing judgment and condemnation for somebody else, you begin to feel really, really guilty. Most Christians I know, if they're really honest, feel terribly guilty all the time. All the time. And I read a quote, and it was kind of harsh, but I think it's true. I think sometimes the church really tries to make people feel realize how terrible they are so we can tell them we can make them feel better. But the reality is we're not helping people feel better because we're kind of telling them you shouldn't do this. But the biblical view of salvation is a little bit different. When you talk about the salvation in biblical tradition, it's always progressive. So, for example, when Paul writes in his letters about what we would call being saved, or you know, in the past tense, being saved, like I was saved then, Paul would write about it in the progressive sense. Like Paul would have said, yeah, I had this experience with Jesus that started me on this journey, but every single moment of my life and every step on the journey has been a process through which God is saving me. And I won't be saved in the past tense until I'm done. When this life is over, looking back, I'll be able to say, God saved me, and He saved me from this, and He saved me from this. He saved me from this attitude. He saved me from this destructive tendency. He saved me from this path away from God. Like, it's at the end of everything, Paul would look back in the past tense and say, saved. Otherwise, Paul would say, in the progressive, I'm being saved. Right here, right now, in this moment, God is saving me. He's saving me from a judgmental attitude. He is saving me from being the kind of person who runs other people down with gossip. He is, in moment by moment, in those small ways, God is saving me. And so when we look at things like, well, I've been saved for 15 years. Or have I been in the process of being saved for 15 years? Those are two totally different things. One means you have arrived, and the other means you're on a journey. One means that you have everything you'll ever need. And one assumes that there is this God who is meeting your needs every single step of the way. On journey, when you mess up and fall short, what you begin to realize is, it isn't that I'm a terrible, ridiculously unlovable person. It's that there's a part of my heart I have not yet given to God. And so in this failure, in this moment, I open myself up to God with that. So it's, hey, you know what? I did the wrong thing here, and I'm on a journey. And I'm learning that when I feel this, what we call, I guess, conviction, when God begins speaking to me, I need to open that up to God as well and let God save that, because there are things in me that aren't completely right yet. Does that make sense? There are parts of me that, even though I've been a Christian a long time, still need God's grace. There are parts of my heart that I've not even let God see yet. There are parts of my heart that I'm holding on to very tightly. And so journey means that every step along the way, I'm just being open to God. So if you have a Bible, turn to Genesis 12. I want to explore this idea. In the biblical tradition, it's not so much a dump truck. It's not so much a ticket. When salvation is talked about in the Bible, it's talked about as journey. And to kind of give you where we're going to be in Genesis 12, I want to look at one verse. Just to get you up to speed, I want to just talk about what happens in Genesis 1 through 11. In Genesis 1 and 2, there are two different creation accounts. If you read them, they're two different stories, but they're both telling you the same thing. They're telling you theologically where the world came from. It's saying that there is this God who with great intention created the world. And He created human beings to be His image bearers in the world, which means God creates people to represent Him to the rest of the world. So people are essentially God's ambassadors in the world. And so God says to the first people, I want you to go and take care of the world. I want you to tend it. I want you to make the garden grow. I want you to name the animals. I want you to take care of creation. But God gives these people choices. And so God gives them the ability to resist His love and His path, or the ability to follow His path and embrace His love. And in Genesis 3, we have this story about the first two people, Adam and Eve, and this snake who convinces them to eat forbidden fruit. And essentially this forbidden fruit in many ways represents human pride, human arrogance. We want to be our own gods. And so the first people take a bite of the fruit and their eyes are opened and they realize that they're naked, they're ashamed, everything's falling apart. And so beginning in Genesis 3, what you begin to see is you begin to see the human project that God started spiral out of control. In Genesis 4, the first two people have two sons, Cain and Abel, and Cain actually kills Abel. And by the time you get throughout Genesis, one of the things we're told is that as the story progresses, that human violence on the earth was becoming more and more prevalent, and that human wickedness was kind of ruining everything God had made and called good. And the height of human arrogance we see in Genesis 11 when the people decide to build a tower reaching to the heavens because they're going to be like God. So the human story, what began good, what began in harmony and peace with everything going the right way, it quickly spirals out of control. And the very human project in itself seems to be in danger. So if you're God, what do you do? When you see the creation that you made and the creation that you love falling apart, what do you do? I mean, can I be honest? If I'm God, I'm going to like grab a megaphone and I'm just going to talk really loud at people. Right? Because that fixes everything, right? So, excuse me, earthlings, I'm God. You will do what I say or else. Right? It's kind of like when you were in school and the principal would begin to make an announcement and they called your name to the office. This is not good news. Right? So when God gets on his big megaphone and says, Josh, I see that. Straighten up. We had one in the 9 o'clock too. It's just like, it's great. So God yells at us. Or God could do this. God could say, here's how I'm going to keep people in line because they need help. Every time somebody does something wrong, I'm going to just zap them with a lightning bolt. Every time. And every time you mess up, God could just shock you with a lightning bolt. And you could kind of like, okay, I'm not going to do that again. He kind of trains you through lightning. God could do all sorts of things to fix the stuff, fix the project. God could send like heavenly beings down to show us the right way. But when the human project is spiraling out of control, what does God do? Who does God get to save the day? He gets a guy and his family. And if you read the story of this guy and his family, sometimes you wonder, did God pick the right people? And I'm sure he wondered this too. But in Genesis 12, we're introduced to a character named Abram. His name later became Abraham. And he later became the father of the Jewish people. He had many sons. And Jesus would look back on Abraham as being his ancestor. So this is about, in some ways, Jesus comes from this moment. But notice in Genesis 12:1, the Lord had said to Abram, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. That's it. No coordinates. No GPS that has a really cool British accent where the lady's telling you, turn right in 500 feet. No, that doesn't. None of that. All he gets is, Abram, get your family. And I know this is your hometown and this is where you're from and everybody knows you and you're next in line to take over your father's business. And I know all that and I get that's your story. But Abram, if you want to be a part of changing the world, if you want to change history, if you want to help me put things back right again, then I want you to pack up, I want you to get your horses and your donkeys and your camels or whatever it is you have, and I want you to leave. And I just kind of imagine, we get just kind of the after of the conversation, like God told Abram to go and he went, but what would you do? What would you do if your husband or wife came home and said, God spoke to me and we're supposed to move to, like Kansas tomorrow? Right? Or for some of you, we're supposed to move to Eastern Kentucky. You people couldn't handle Eastern. No. What if? I mean, like, don't you think they're a little cuckoo? Don't you say, like, okay, if God wants us to go, surely God's telling us where to go. But he doesn't. He just tells Abram, saddle up and follow me. And this is how the story of rescue and redemption begins in the Bible. Not with a big, loud, booming voice for all of creation to hear, but an invitation, maybe even in his heart. Abram had this holy restlessness that he sensed, God is drawing me somewhere else. Where I can't stay where I'm at and be in the plan that this God, whoever he is, has for the world. And Abram goes. We put it like this, redemptive history. So redemptive history, the Jesus story, we would say, begins with an invitation to a journey. Without Abram saying yes to God's invitation, we don't have Jesus. The entire project of God putting the world right again begins with this one guy and his family saying yes to an invitation, not to a destination, but to a journey, to the place I'll show you. Abram says yes, and history changes forever. And what's interesting about Abram's story is if you read it all, Abram and his wife Sarah were very, very old. They're like 100. She was 90. So they were unable to have children. And God tells him, I'm going to make you a father. I'm actually going to give you a son. And Abraham kind of goes, oh, okay. whatever. But you read Abram's story and you'll find out he doesn't always get it right. There are times when he doesn't really trust God. And so he lies and he gets in a whole big mess of trouble. I mean, all sorts of things go wrong. We look back on Abram like, man, he had such faith. Sometimes. And sometimes he told lies, and sometimes he didn't believe God, and sometimes he got in hot water because of it. The story of how God rescues the world is he takes fallible people who completely mess things up, and he says, if you'll trust me and you'll follow me, we're going to change the world together. So grab your stuff and let's go, and I'll tell you where we're going when we get there. Redemptive history begins with a journey, an invitation to follow. And I think this is true because it's true about life. Life isn't static. Journey is central to the Bible because journey is central to life. Life isn't static. It is dynamic. And here's what that means. Life doesn't stay the same. It always changes. That's true physically for us, isn't it? I asked somebody once, when do you really feel like a grown-up? Like, when do you feel like a grown-up? When do you really feel like, I'm a grown-up? Because that's, imagine what I think grown-ups do. They just kind of walk around, I'm a grown-up. When do you feel like a grown-up? And this person was like 70. He said, I don't know, I haven't gotten there yet. Like, but what happens is you begin to age, and you try to do something you used to do when you're 18, and you can't get out of bed the next day. Because you've changed. You've gotten older. I got a haircut this last week. And before I went to get my haircut, I was noticing that in the sides of my hair and the top, when it gets longer, you can really see little bits of gray coming in. That wasn't there 2, 3, 4 years ago. That's new. That's something new. Right? Life is constant change. You're not the same person you used to be. And we resist this because there's so many things. We try to keep so many things the same. How many of you go to the same restaurant and order the same thing every time you go to the same restaurant? Anybody? Yeah. Why do we do that? We want some of that same stuff. We want the same thing, the same thing. But life really isn't always the same. It changes. We change personally. Hopefully, we aren't thinking the same way we thought 20 years ago. Hopefully, our faith has grown. Hopefully, our ideas have expanded. Hopefully, our mind has become open to new things that we can. Just hopefully, we're not the same. We change physically. I believe it's true spiritually. The spiritual life is not supposed to be static. It's dynamic. Which means that if we stay in the exact same spot we are spiritually now, if we're the exact same place spiritually in 10 years, something is going wrong. Because when we stop growing and changing as people, it means we're not alive anymore. And when we stop growing and changing spiritually, it means that inside of us, spiritually, something has died. It's not as it should be. Life isn't static. It's not always this flat, level, easy thing. Life has ups and downs, and it's full of all sorts of surprises, and so is the spiritual life. And there should be seasons where you're growing unbelievably, and maybe seasons where you're kind of plateaued, and that's just part of the rhythm. But the question is, are you in the same spot? Because if you're in the same spot, then we have issues. And this is what journey is all about. It's about just being on the journey and not staying plateaued and flat. Everything's always changing. Church is always changing, right? Things are always different. We don't do church like our grandparents did church. We think about things differently. We do things differently. I was talking to a friend yesterday, and he said, you know, it's always awkward when you go to a church for the first time and you sit in the pew that's somebody else's seat. Because you didn't know they were assigned, right? And so you sit in somebody else's seat, and you're in their pew, and it's got their family name on the end of it. And then they come in, and they just kind of give you the stink eye for like 45 minutes during the service, because they can't worship God because they're in the wrong seat, right? Which I told him, if you want to fix that, just rearrange stuff like we do, and then nobody will know where their seat is. Like, where's my seat? It's over there. Pick one. But we get in those ruts, and we get stuck, and life isn't that way, though. I think we hold on to those things because life is so dynamic, and it's always changing. Some of you have kids who it's like yesterday they were 3, and now they're 30. It's like yesterday you were bringing them home from the hospital, and now they're driving. Yesterday you brought this beautiful baby girl home, and now some boy is trying to call her. And you want him to know what you think about that. Right? But life is always changing. Now, because that's true, because life isn't static, it's dynamic, there are certain things we have to try on this journey to make sure of. And I would say this. First, we have to make sure that we have continuity and innovation at the same time. So continuity is when things are the same. So there should be a thread when we talk about, let's just talk about our church for a minute. There should be a thread going through our church that has continuity with every other church in church history, right? There are certain things that we just do to keep us grounded in the faith. For example, we do Advent. We just finished up Advent, which is a practice Christians started in the 300s. That is a very, very old church tradition. We're about to go into Lent. Ash Wednesday is February 13th. We'll begin the season of Lent with Ash Wednesday. And if you came to Ash Wednesday last year, for me, that service last year was probably the most meaningful service I've been to in such a long time. It was, and we read old, old prayers, and we quoted some old, old people, and we immersed ourselves in our history. And we need that. We need that continuity. We need to know where we came from, right? It's important to know that we're not just kind of out there floating around on our own. And for us as a non-denominational church, that can be one of the dangers, right? We're just kind of, we're not tied to any particular denomination. We just like the best of all of them. And so we don't really, like, how do we make sure we're grounded? Well, we go back into church history and we try to keep ourselves grounded with practices that Christians have always done for thousands of years. But at the same time, while we're holding on with one hand to that continuity, we also have to be pushing forward with innovation on the other hand. Innovation means something new, something different, something we haven't tried before. It means you're breaking new ground. It means you're not stuck in the old forms. You don't let them bind you. You break out of them and you try something new. You take risks to try to communicate this message with people who maybe have never heard it before, and who, if we communicated it in the way they did in the 3rd century, 4th century, or the 20th century, that people wouldn't connect with. And so we're trying to find new ways of expression, new forms of presenting this message. One of my first pastor gigs was in college my senior year. And it was in a really small church in a college town, and they were used to having pastors who would be there like 2 years, or 3 years while they were in school, and then they would kind of graduate and go off other places. And they asked me, you know, I was preaching there some, they said, hey, would you come and be our pastor? And I said yes, and because I knew everything, and I wanted to help them, because I knew exactly what to do at church. I had all figured out, and so I went in, and I was going to help them be innovative. That was what I was going to do. And so my idea was to just change everything on the first Sunday. And I don't know if you know this about me, but there was this pulpit up front. You know what a pulpit is? It's this big, this big box that has sides. And every time I would use one, I always wanted to like grab a hold of it and drive it somewhere. And I just didn't know what to do with myself. So I said, can we just take that off and put it in the back, because I don't know what to do with it. And so they had two deacons in the church, really small church. And they said, absolutely, we'll move it right now. So they moved it in the back. And I get up the first Sunday and I'm about ready to start the teaching. And I noticed that all these people are crying. And I'm thinking, man, you haven't even started yet. And they're already weeping under conviction. This is beautiful. Come to find out, the founding pastor's grandfather, on his deathbed, hand-whittled this pulpit from like a solid piece of oak. And they were going to crucify me. And I said to the two deacon guys, this is information that would have been helpful on the front end. You know, you could have told me that this was like brother so-and-so's grandfather's last act or something. You could have told me. We could have moved it to the side. You know, we could have done something. But so there's this sense like we need some continuity with the past, but we also don't need to be afraid to try something new and to do things in new ways. I would put it like this too. We need tradition. When I was growing up and learning about church and leading church, tradition was a bad word. It was akin to cursing. Tradition is the problem, and tradition is not the problem. Our view of tradition may be the problem, because I think for a lot of people, when they think about tradition in church and when they think about tradition in theology, they think that everything important that needed to be said was said in the 1500s. The 1500s is when Martin Luther tacked his 95 theses on the door, the church door at Wittenberg on Halloween. It's when the Protestant Reformation came and you had people drawing lines in the sand and saying, we've always thought about God this way, but what if God's not that way? What if God's like this? And we've always read the Bible this way, but what if that's not what it means? And what if it means this? And people were speaking a bold, fresh word from the Bible. And often when you talk to Christians, everything we think and believe is grounded then. Well, what did they say? And we don't think about it that way, but everything we've probably always heard has been, for some people it's like the 1950s, that was a good era. But for most people it's like, what did Martin Luther say? Because that's what we believe. Whether you know who Martin Luther is or not, that's probably what you believe, is what Martin Luther believed. And so there's this sense where we begin to, and we don't need that kind of, there's a certain sense where we need to look back and think, they changed a lot of things. They spoke a bold word, and we're grateful for what they said. But while we need to hang on to tradition, we also need to keep searching for truth. We need to keep pushing forward in our search for what's true. Because I believe, just like then, they spoke a bold, fresh word about the Bible and about God, there may be times now, in the 21st century, when we read a text and we say, you know what, I don't know. But that's exactly, maybe there's still a bold, fresh word to be spoken about the Bible and what it means. Maybe there's a bold, fresh word to be spoken about God. Maybe we haven't heard everything we need to hear. Maybe we don't have all the truth figured out. Maybe we need more. Maybe we need to explore more. Maybe we need to ask more questions. Maybe we need to doubt things more so that we can find faith, because I believe faith and doubt are so deeply connected. Maybe we need to stop being satisfied with pat answers and cliches that have been handed down to us from generation to generation. And maybe we need to start saying, yes, but what if we really wrestled with this? Could the Spirit of God who spoke to Paul, and the Spirit of God who spoke to Luther, and the Spirit of God who spoke to our grandparents, could that same Spirit speak to us today so that we have something new and fresh to offer? Not because it's new to God, but because it's new to us. And so there's this sense where we need tradition. We need to be able to say yes, and here's what Martin Luther said, and here's what our grandparents said about this. But we also need to not be afraid to say, but there's more truth out there, and we need to push forward. And maybe in 20, 30, 40, 50, 100, 1,000, 1,500 years, there'll be some people sitting at a church in Morgantown, Kentucky, which may be in outer space by then. We just don't know what's going to happen. But wherever we are, like on the Jetsons up there somewhere, whatever happens, they'll look back and they'll say, you know what? Our great-great-great-grandparents 1,500 years ago, or however many greats you need to add on to that to get back that far, they spoke a fresh, bold word about God. And that inspires us to do the same thing. How many of you, when you pick up the Bible and read it, sometimes if you're honest, you think, boring? Because we know it, right? We know what that means. We know what those stories are. I could tell you the end of the story when you start it. Just name one. Boom, end of the story. Spoiler alert. And it's become flat. It's become two-dimensional. Because we think, A, we've read it before, and B, we know everything there is to know about this. And when you approach the Bible and you assume there's still truth, we haven't gotten out of that, and maybe we've read it this way for a long, long time, but maybe this passage means something else. And maybe God isn't that way, but maybe God is better than that. It frees you up in all sorts of new ways to be excited about faith. And it frees you up in all sorts of ways. I tell my Wednesday night group, we get together and we just talk. And we just go through. People just ask questions and we chase rabbits. And it's all sorts of fun. But one of the things I tell them constantly is, I am less sure about a lot of things than I used to be. But I am more interested in and connected with Jesus now than I ever have been. And it's because I really believe there's something fresh to learn. And I really believe new discoveries are out there. I read the Bible because I believe there's stuff in it that I haven't seen, and maybe nobody else has yet. I want to find it because I want it to shape who I'm becoming as a follower of Jesus. One of my favorite writers, Brian McLaren, wrote a book in 2005 that just completely messed my head up in a really positive way. It really started. I had all sorts of questions and things I struggled with about church and about faith. And when I read this book, I found out that other people had them too, that it was okay to ask these questions. And the book's called A Generous Orthodoxy. And toward the end, he says something that I think really just nails down what this journey is about. Sit down with me in this little restaurant and ask me if Christianity, my version of it, your version of it, the Pope's version, whoever's, because when you have three people in the room, you have four opinions and versions of Christianity, right? I mean, that's just how it is. Everybody sees it differently. Ask me if Christianity is orthodox, regardless of the version. Meaning true. Is Christianity orthodox? Is it true? And here's my honest answer. A little, but not yet. Assuming by Christianity you mean the Christian understanding of the world and God, Christian opinions on soul, text, and culture, I'd have to say that we probably have a couple things right, but a lot of things wrong. And even more spreads before us as unseen and unimagined. But at least our eyes, are open. To be a Christian in a generously orthodox way is not to claim that we have the truth captured, stuffed, and mounted on the wall. It is rather to be in a loving community of people, a church, who are seeking the truth on the road of mission and who have been launched on the quest by Jesus, who with us guides us still. Do we have it? Have we taken hold of it? Not fully, not yet, of course not. But we keep seeking. We're finding enough to keep us going, but we're not finished. The best sense to me of Christianity is to realize that regardless of what you hold about this, this, or this, and there are certain core truths we hold, and the rest of them we debate. But the central thing is this: truth is not something we capture; it captures us. Truth is not something that we have stuffed and mounted on the wall, so that we can say, "Yeah, we figured that out. We figured that out. We got that nailed. We're done with that. Yep, we're done. Got the whole Bible figured out. We're going to tell you what it means." When we're there, we are so far from the next step on the journey. I believe that there is an orthodox Christian faith. I don't believe that anybody has figured out what that looks like. I believe we all have bits and pieces of it. And I believe we're on the journey trying to figure out what that is. But I think there's a lot more to learn. I think there's more to learn. I think there are more bold, fresh words to be spoken. I think the reason people are bored at church is because we're just repeating the same things and we're not really wrestling with what's true. Richard Rohr says it like this. I think it's true. We must never presume that we see. We must always be ready to see anew. God through Isaiah in the scriptures, says it like this, "My ways are not your ways." When you think you have God conquered, when you think you have truth mounted and stuffed on the wall, then you are actually walking away from more truth and more of God than you could ever imagine, because ultimately God's a mystery. And our best efforts are peering into a mystery. And I think Paul put it like this, and I think Paul's spot on. Now, Paul, if you don't know about Paul's story, here's Paul's story. He started out as a devout Jew who saw Christianity as a threat. And so Paul started out persecuting Christians. So he would like have Christians thrown in jail and he would supervise their executions. And Paul was really anti. He wanted to snuff out the church. And so Paul turns from a persecutor of Christians to a pastor and church planter. And he has a complete total shift in what life's all about. From wanting to kill Christians to wanting to give his entire self to Jesus and follow him. And so Paul, I think we look back on Paul, and Paul's kind of like the celebrity in Christian history, right? I think for a lot of us, Paul sometimes eclipses Jesus, but Paul's kind of the guy. If anybody had this all figured out, who would it be? It'd be Paul, right? If anybody, like if you want to sit down with a church historian and talk about Christianity, like pick Paul, because Paul's got it all figured out. Notice what he says here. "Not that I have already obtained all this or have arrived at my goal, but I press on to take hold of that for which Christ Jesus took hold of me. Brothers and sisters, I do not consider myself yet to have taken hold of it. But one thing I do, forgetting what is behind and straining toward what is ahead, I press on toward the goal to win the prize for which God has called me heavenward in Christ Jesus." See, here's the deal. When salvation is all about one moment, one experience, and God backs the dump truck up on you and gives it all to you, and then you go and mess up, all that's left there is guilt and shame because you haven't lived up to it. But on journey, when you mess up, you realize there's another part of me that needs to be surrendered to God. When you find yourself with a bitter heart, then it is not an opportunity for guilt and shame. It's an opportunity to say, "God, there's a part of me that wants to be angry at this person and to not let it go, and I need your help in forgiving them." It's when you find yourself wanting to take the wrong step and go down the wrong path, and it's when you realize I'm doing the wrong thing and I'm not living the way God has created me to live, and I'm making bad choices, I'm not doing the right thing. Then it's not to like feel terrible about it and just run and hide. It's to open yourself up to God in that moment and say, "God, I realize I'm unfinished. And I'm opening my heart up to you moment by moment by moment. And I'm asking you to change me moment by moment by moment." I put it like this. I really believe we're unfinished. We're not done yet. But we're going to take the next step. And that's really all God invites us to do. Just take the next step. Often people come to church and we give them the next 15 things they need to do. You need to believe this, 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 you make this decision, you need to jump in that tub, you need to do this, 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 and this. And I think that's a little overwhelming. And what we find God doing with Abram is this. "Abram, you want to change the world? Take one step. Take one step out of town. Take one step toward my voice. Take one step toward my call. And you're going to change the world." I wonder how many of us are stuck on a step we were on years ago. Because we kind of believe that salvation is more about waiting than it is about joining what God is doing. Our church is going to turn 17 in June. That's really kind of crazy. My first church anniversary service here was year 9. And we're getting older as a church and we're growing through adolescence. But you know what I believe? Like deep down in my gut, I believe our best days are ahead. I do. I believe my best days are ahead. I hope that in another 17, 20 years, I look back on my life right now and say, "You know what? I was unbelievably blessed then. I was unbelievably grateful then, but my best days are still ahead." And I hope in 20 years, I'm looking toward the future and going, "My best days are still ahead." I believe your best days are still ahead. Personally, for you, I believe the best days are still in front of you. I don't know how long I'm going to live or how long you're going to live. I don't know if I'm going to live another 5 years, another 50 years, another 600 years. I'm banking and hoping for the last one. We'll see how things go. But I hope at the end of that, I look back on every step of the journey and I realize my best years were still ahead. I hope as a church, when our kids or grandkids take this thing over, and they're doing all kinds of stuff, and they're playing their music too loud and rearranging the seats in weird ways. I really hope that they look back on our time and that they believe, because we believe, that their best days are still ahead. You know why I believe that's true? I believe it's true because I think there's more truth to be learned. I think there's more of God that we haven't even tapped into yet. I think there's more mystery that we haven't been invited into yet. I think there's more parts of us we haven't surrendered yet. And I think as we do those things, tomorrow can only be better and better and better, because every step I take moves me closer and closer to who God called me to be. One of my favorite writers and pastors is a guy named Eugene Peterson. He translated the Bible called The Message. He's got a memoir called The Pastor. And it's essentially about his story about how he accidentally sort of became a pastor and his journey as a pastor. And he said that he had somebody in his life, I think it was his grandma or I can't remember who, but who used to tell him that every step was an arrival. Every step is an arrival. And what he took from that was that there are many, many more to be steps to be taken. But every time I take a step, I'm arriving in a new place with new possibilities, with new hope, with new territory. It's all new. And I believe that every time we take a step, we arrive in a new place. And that place is full of opportunity to do good, to be a blessing to others, to serve our community, to love. I think every step we take as a church, I think every step you take as a parent, as a spouse, as a person at your job, every step you take toward God opens up new possibilities. I believe our best days are still ahead. I can't wait to see what I hope when we look back in 17 years, we're going, man, we were so blessed at year 17, but gosh, we weren't even close to where we are now. And we're still so far away, but we're so much more filled with joy, and we have such a deeper sense of gratitude, and we're serving people more, and we're loving more. We love each other more. Like, every single step on the way has brought us closer together. That's my prayer. My prayer is that you believe it too. That your life, your family, this church, our best days are out in front of us. So the real question is how do we get there? And it's really just taking the next right step. And I don't know what your step is. I don't know what the step God has placed in front of you. I would bet many of us there's been a step God has placed right in front of us again and again. And we've run from it. And we're hiding from it because we feel like it's too difficult and it asks too much of us. And I would say we begin there. For some of you, it's to begin where you've been hiding from God. And it's to confront that step He's called you to and to say, yes. Yes, God, I'll do it. Whatever it is, I'll do it. Yes, I'll jump into a small group even though it's uncomfortable for me. Yes, I'll lead a small group even though I have no idea what I'm doing. Yes, I'll step up and trust you in a more deep way there. God, yes, I'll do whatever. Yes, I'll make peace with that person. Yes, I'll seek forgiveness. Yes, I'll seek to be more compassionate. God, whatever that next step for us is. For some of us, I assume for some of us the next step would be to just begin to entertain the fact that there might be a God. And for some of us that may be a huge leap, and that's okay. It's just the next right step. For some of us, it would be to surrender ourselves to this journey and say, I trust that this Jesus leads us toward the path God has laid out for us, to the path of life and love, and I want to follow this Jesus on this path. And for some of us, it would be to open ourselves up to that truth and embrace it right now. For others, it's to continue to ask questions. Whatever your step is, my prayer is that that we would wrestle with that, and that we would, as God empowers us, that we would take that. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to offer a prayer in just a moment, but I'm just going to let us sit in silence for a few seconds and just listen to the rain. Maybe a little awkward, but I just want to give us some time to kind of internalize where we are on the journey and ask ourselves and ask God to show us, God, what is this next step? Where are you calling us? Because our church will never take the next step until we, brothers and sisters, take the next step. So let's just have a moment of quiet. Let's listen to the rain. Let's try to stay awake. And then we'll have a word of prayer. God, we're grateful that wherever we are on our journey is okay with you. Your call to us is just to the next right step. I entrust that your Spirit is far more capable than I am of guiding people toward what that is. So it's our prayer that we would entrust ourselves to your Spirit, that through the Spirit you would speak to us about the next right step for us. Whatever that looks like, however challenging it is, help us to not run from you but to you. We entrust that this Jesus leads us on the path toward wholeness and healing. And we entrust that when we take the next step, however frightening it may have been, like Abraham stepping out into the unknown, we trust that you're with us every step of the way. God, may we not leave this moment and kind of put it behind us. May we realize we aren't saved, we're being saved. And that means moment by moment, step by step, is an opportunity for another step on the journey, another way to trust you, another way to surrender ourselves to you. And so we trust that you're good. We trust that your grace holds us up when we fall. We trust that the next right step is all you're asking from us. We pray this in the strong name of Jesus. And everybody said,